This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Friday, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, here with us. Welcome, George. How are you today?
Hello, Meera. I'm very good. Yes. Excited as usual.
We're going to be discussing an article or a news release, 28th of June, actually, of this year, where an oncologist in Singapore was suspended for 8 months for professional misconduct. Now, yes. It was a very interesting case. So we decided to invite two oncologists to come on and share their thoughts with us. Two very powerful ladies, actually.
I'm shivering.
Doctor, yes, you better. There are three of us now. Yeah. Dr. Mastura Mohammad Yusuf, she's a consultant oncologist, and Professor Wu Yin Ling, she's a gynae oncologist at University of Malaya. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are you today?
Thanks for having us, Meera.
Thank you.
I'm just going to go very quickly with George. What did you think of this article when you first read it?
To be honest with you, when you sent me the article, I didn't even read it. I would just say, these Singapore oncologists are in trouble again. Obviously, if we recall about 5 years ago, they were in trouble with the Brunei royal family for overcharging. So the only thing I thought about is like, oh, this is cost-related issues. But when I read through it, I was alert. I was cautioned about the responsibility we take as doctors. On the other hand, I also was a little bit concerned about the direction we're heading in Southeast Asia. I mean, in a nutshell, essentially, this is an oncologist being suspended for giving misinformation about treatment. So let's say, we're going to go into details of that. And essentially, giving misinformation, there are consequences. So that will have a huge amount of implication, both as a healthcare provider and also healthcare receiver. So I'm really looking forward to discussing this topic today.
So just a background, 7 years ago, Dr. Ang Peng Tiam presented false information and unsubstantiated advice to a lung cancer patient. So two of the daughters of the patient made a complaint against Dr. Ang in 2010, shortly after the patient died at the age of 55 from lung cancer because it had spread to the other parts of the body. And in July last year, the Singapore Medical Council's disciplinary tribunal found him guilty of two of the four charges levelled against him. And that was he made false representation to the patient that there was a 70% chance of her lung cancer responding to treatment that he suggested, and that he failed to offer her surgery as an option. So the tribunal said that Dr. Ang had no reasonable basis for saying that there was a 70% chance of response and that he had wrongly held out false hope to the patient and her family. Dr. Mastura, what did you think? This is really up your alley. The both of you are oncologists. I mean, does it sort of scare you in a way, because you really need to be like on the ball? It's sort of a reminder that you really have to be on the ball, really.
Okay. So it's like this, if you look at 20, 30 years back, in lung cancer, we probably have just a handful of options, okay? So maybe at that time, doctors were expected to be probably empathetic, and then give supportive care, something like that. But we are now 20, 30 years ahead, where we have a lot of innovation. There has been a lot of changes, and treatment has improved so much that we have more options to deliver to our patients. So the onus and the responsibility is on us to keep ourselves updated. And from the beginning, the point of diagnosing the patient, we have to know about all the molecular alteration that we can test on the lung cancer specimen, to the staging of the patient. We have to be accurate in staging the patient so that we can accurately plan the patient's treatment, as well as prognostication of the patient. That means looking at what is the outcome, okay? And with the information at hand, then we have to plan a plan of treatment together with a team with the best potential outcome that we could give to the patient, bearing in mind that there are also a lot of clinical research that we can also explore besides whatever options that we already have at hand. And then with the team, we decide with the patient and give them a very clear and very, I would say, sensitive to their needs, remembering that we are Asians, we have our cultural beliefs and all that. But as long as we have done all that in a very systematic manner and using evidence base in order to decide or to give suggestion, the option to the patient, and explain to them in a clear manner and come a conclusion as to how we are going to now carry on with the plan. And talking about planning the treatment in a team, I must also emphasize that each of the team member, the multidisciplinary team that is that is planning the lung cancer patient, the treatment for the lung cancer, each of the people in the team must know when when and what to explain to the patient. For example, if I am going to refer the patient to the surgeon, then I will not disclose, you know, this explicit detail about the surgery to the patient, because and leave that to the surgeon to discuss all the risks that are involved. Okay? And then when the surgeon has done all that they have to do, then the aspect about the pathological results, what is to be given after that, will be given back to the oncologist to discuss with the patient. So you sort of give the patient a plan, but you leave to your team members to discuss what and when with the patient so that the patient is not confused. Okay? And rather than treating the patient alone.
Where did you think things fell through the cracks here? There's no mention of a team, actually, in whatever that I've read so far. Then my next question is, who's really the captain? Somebody needs to take responsibility, right? Well, there's only one captain.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the team because, you know, I've worked in two places where I thought the team effort is paramount. In the UK, you know, after shipment and everything, these are all the kind of NHS disaster that actually caused a tremendous amount of controversy. And then now, a lot of decisions when it comes to cancer all has to go through this team. The team, huge number of people, and they only meet once a week. Are you saying it's such a fuss? You know, it's kind of, why do you have to not just let the surgeon take charge and then get on and remove the organ? In this setting, I really think the team eliminated that whole idea of like the one captain, and then if that captain falls foul, and then there's no safety net. I mean, the second place that I work really well is, like, you know, Prof Wu probably can actually start talking a little bit about gynecological oncology. And then is that I think University of Malaya, you guys have extremely robust multidisciplinary team, right? That's why both of you work closely together.
Mm-hmm. So I think from the patient's perspective, let's remove some of this jargon, multidisciplinary team meeting or tumor board. What it means that it is a group of doctors who are familiar with different tools of managing cancer. Some patients don't even meet the radiologist or the interventional radiologist in the background who has a major role in determining how we manage cancers. So ideally, in an ideal situation, a patient will meet the captain. It may be a surgeon, it may be an oncologist. The oncologist in a complicated situation, the captain will say, right, let's get the team together and see which is the best route we should take. Mm-hmm. In this case, it appears that the captain was quite confident, or the oncologist was very confident that his method was the right method and there were no avenues for different roles or surgery to come in.
Who decides on, you know, who the captain is?
The first person who sees a patient, I guess.
Yeah. Patients will actually go and meet, for example, in this patient, she has been diagnosed with cancer, but she has been thoroughly investigated because she has had PET scan, she has had MRI of the brain. These are all the preliminary investigations that we or the team do in order for us to plan the patient's management. So she has had all those done, and when she sees the captain decides to treat as such.
Okay.
Well, something that I would quite like to highlight, because obviously for the two centres that I worked with previously, they're all government institutions, like, you know, University of Malaya and then also NHS. However, in a private practice, to get everyone together is almost impossible. That's number one. I mean, being in private practice at the moment. And so also the other players might not even want to share that responsibility to some extent, because, you know, whenever you get everyone together, it's not every cases are so straightforward. Mm-hmm. So you might get a surgeon who wants to make a decision, and then the oncologist might kind of say, look, I might not feel the same way, but I don't want to contribute to this because I don't have obligation to do that. I feel that sometimes the healthcare system doesn't allow that sort of multidisciplinary approach to cancer care which is quite sad in a private practice.
Okay, so we'll come back to that in just a short while, because that is sometimes, I think, a double-edged sword here in Malaysia, the private and the government sector. And we haven't even come to cost yet, because, you know, the bills that some people come up with from private sector when it comes to cancer treatment is unbelievable.
That's right.
And, you know, based on research, almost more than half of our cancer patients are financially challenged after the first year of treatment. So that's an area we'll come back to in a while. But who decides? So in the end, in this case, for an example, Dr. Mastura, so he made this decision. And he's a very prominent oncologist.
He's medical director for this big organization.
Exactly.
A big cancer center.
That's right.
Yes, and he also was Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's principal doctor in 1992 when he was treated for lymphoma. So he had seen, 16,000 new patients over the past 16 years. Over 10% to 15% suffered from lung cancer. So that's a large number that he's actually treated. But then there's this question of overconfidence. Do you think that was the case in a way?
I think to become a good oncologist is not just about
numbers.
Experience, skill and numbers, but it's about constantly updating yourself with the most recent knowledge and innovation and advances in the
field
itself, because the field is rapidly advancing, actually, especially lung cancer. I can tell you there are probably more than 200 clinical trials at the moment looking at how to improve some more on the outcome of patients with lung cancer. So in this scenario where the patient has a cancer that was confined just to the lung, you can ask 10 oncologists who probably is well-versed with what is the current recommendation or what is in the recommended guidelines, international guidelines, that surgery is a cornerstone of the treatment for patients who have a tumour that's probably stage 1 or 2, which is confined just at the peripheral of the lung. So surgery is a cornerstone treatment for this kind of cases. If surgery is not possible because of medical mobility, that means the patient is not fit to undergo surgery, or because the patient is not willing to take the risk of surgery, then the next course of action is actually to consider radiotherapy because we are looking for cure.
I mean, this is a case of lung cancer. Can you tell us, kind of walk us through how, let's say, a gynecological cancer is presented to your center? And then, first of all, I would like to discuss what happened if there are conflict in the decision making. Let's say, you did have disagreement, and also how do you guys keep up to date of what sort of information, because there's a wealth of information.
I can
out
tell
there.
You, I can't, couldn't even get a date with the both of them.
That's right.
They are traveling all over, presenting papers, absorbing papers. I don't know what's going
That's
on.
That's right. I mean, sometimes, it's good that we keep updated. However, to how? Some extent, that we might be skewed towards one area of our interest.
That's
right. So how do you have a broad sense of knowledge in order to serve your patient well?
I think that broad sense of knowledge, the center of that must be the clinician, the main clinician, and the captain herself or himself must know the patient well. Whatever guidelines you follow, whatever management you decide to take as a group, one must always be aware that the patient themselves are unique. So sometimes we forget about that when we discuss a case in a multidisciplinary team meeting. For example, some of these targeted therapies are very expensive, exorbitant, but it is an option or a choice. But when it comes to the patient, they can't afford it. So in University Malaya, for patients who present with gynae cancers, the simpler cases can be dealt with by a single surgeon or, say, a clinical oncologist. For example, in advanced cervical cancer, it's very clear that the patient should not have surgery. They should have radiotherapy. And for ovarian cancer, we then discuss whether we should give them chemotherapy first or surgery. Now, there shouldn't be too much of a conflict of interest, because as a profession, we are guided by what we call clinical guidelines. So for cancers, we have good clinical guidelines with which patients have access to, and it gives us a guideline as to what we should do. So most of the cases, we come to a consensus in our practice.
So eventually you have to come to an agreement.
That's right.
I mean, Prof, I know you're on kind of a personal basis that you're obviously super specialized in gynecological cancers. You were consultant in Cambridge before. And obviously you were working in a setting where resources is almost limitless.
That's right.
In addition to that, you're working in an environment where at the click of your finger, you can have the best mind in the world, key opinion leaders. How do you kind of bring that sort of service to a Malaysian setting where limited resources and also you may not have access to that sort of brains?
I think that's why when we do research and clinical care, and Mira knows about this, it has to always be Malaysian-centric. Even when you talk about government patients and private patients, how, you know, you have to really look at the patient and work from that perspective. I've come from a setting, you're right, whereby everything is available. But I think to be effective in a place where I practice, I work with what I have. And that's the best we can do. You don't give up. You work with whatever tools you have. Instead of having a CT scan the next hour, it may be that I have to wait for 2 weeks. And manage those expectations with the patients.
Okay. Sarah, is that quite frustrating?
We'll come back and hear your thoughts on that transition and functioning as an oncologist, working in a multidisciplinary team and all of that. We're discussing patient rights and ethics in line with Dr. Ang Peng Tiam in Singapore, who was an oncologist who was suspended for 8 months for professional misconduct, actually. Well, they found that he had made false representation to the patient. There was a 70% chance of her lung cancer responding to treatment and that he failed to offer her surgery as an option. And the patient died in 2010. We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. We're discussing medical ethics today with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, Prof. Wu Yin Ling, she's a gynecological oncologist at University of Malaya, and Dr. Masra Mohammad Yusuf, she's a consultant oncologist. We're discussing the case of Dr. Ang Peng Tiam in Singapore, an oncologist who has been suspended for 8 months for professional misconduct. We were talking about transitioning as far as resources is concerned and all of that. Dr. Masra, you've moved from the government sector to the private sector. Did that make a difference in how you manage the patients now?
It doesn't make any difference in the sense of principle. I think my principle remains the same. Okay, I manage the patient according to evidence-based medicine, according to the international or even local clinical practice guidelines. So I just want to share that there are various tools that we can use to actually decide on the management of the patient, because sometimes we do get overwhelmed with all the wealth of knowledge that we have to keep ourselves updated to. So there are engines, search engines that we can use. For example, we have UpToDate, which is a website that actually engages more than 6,000 physicians, editors, as well as peer reviewers to look at what is the latest updates in oncology, oncological management, and then they form a synopsis kind of. So it's very it's helpful for the clinician, those who are in clinical practice, to be up to date with what is the latest management. Then we also have predictive tool, for example, such as the Predict NHS UK, where we use that to look at our patient survival from breast cancer, for example. So we could actually estimate in real life based on the results from patients before this. So in order for us to basically inform our patients, if you are going to take chemotherapy, for example, these are the expected increment in your survival advantage, for example. So this can be used also. And there's, of course, the international guidelines. So we have our European Society of Medical Oncology, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. These are consensus guidelines that are made by leading experts in each of the field that they are talking, they are experts in. So we use that as a guide for us to manage our patients. So we give all these options to our patients.
Sure. Did you find Dr. Ang's decision mind-boggling?
Oh, that's a very good question.
She has to be very careful.
Oncologist. For me, it was mind-boggling, and I'm the layperson, because he has admitted to the tribunal that the surgery was the only prospect of cure.
That's right.
And that the patient might have up to 20% chance of being cured with surgery.
Well, that begs the question, why?
Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking.
Because if you look at the SEER database, for even for stage 1 and stage 2 patients, their survival
with an
expectation is 50%.
Yeah.
How do you manage expectations with lung cancer? Because it often, we all know, people present late, you know, and as a result, you know, your survival and is poor, right? Mm. So when it comes to staging and giving people hope, life expectancy, how do you do that?
Well, when
you're almost playing God here, you know, in a way.
Shouldn't.
In a way.
Yeah, we don't. We actually, no, it's case by case basis. But I think if you don't give people hope, you are basically killing their soul in a way. Okay, so not everybody. It's like some patients can have advanced stage lung cancer, but it doesn't mean that it's not treatable. So patients with advanced lung cancer now, if you can actually identify their subtype and look at the mutation that we can actually target with certain drugs, they can actually live longer than if they did not have the treatment, for example. So it's not to say every patient does not have hope. But at the same time, we cannot also give them false hope. For example, if they have lung cancer and they are in stage 3 lung cancer, for example, so we tell them we are going to treat you with this course of therapy, your expected control rate or your expected survival rate is this much. So ultimately, if you have a recurrence, we are going to do this. So it's a plan. You already tell the patient that they may have a risk of a recurrence, even though they have, they're going to go through this treatment. So what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with the recurrence next? So that is something that you lay out the course for the patient rather than telling them, I'm going to give you this treatment. It's going to be curative. The curative percent is 90%, for example. That is like giving patients with lung cancer false hope, although they have early stage disease. So we know that stage 1 and stage 2 lung cancer, despite having the best surgery there is, there's always a risk of recurrence later.
What do you mean by false hope, Prof Wu?
Yeah, Mira, I want to go back a little bit because we've spent half the show talking about how doctors manage patients. I mean, what's important is how do the patients deal with the diagnosis? I think that's quite important. Mm-hmm. I think patients need to dare to ask questions. If they don't understand what we terms like stage and subtype, they should really ask their doctors about that. What are the treatment options? There's not always just one treatment option. If it's not surgery, you can have radiotherapy because they all treat local disease. And they must be brave enough to get another opinion if there's no trust or they're not comfortable with that.
You know, Prof, we'll often, as soon as you tell a patient they've got cancer, everything shuts down.
That's right.
Well, and also, in some way, the patient will just give you the complete trust and say, you know, you know best. And then, you know, for this case, Dr. Ang, you know, he probably can't think of anyone better to trust upon. And then, so obviously, there is a miscalculation somewhere or misunderstanding somewhere. I mean, it's interesting when you ask the questions of, you know, does it mind boggle? And in fact, it actually raised some degree of concerns. I mean, in my opinion, number one, it actually highlights accountability. So whatever we say to patient, it has to be accountable.
Correct.
You know, because at the end of the day, this is a good example how it can come back to haunt you. If you don't know, don't come up with information that is misleading because it will cost life.
I think Mira's point here is that he knew.
That's right. Well,
he knew.
So who holds him accountable?
That's right. Okay. Right? I mean, that's...
So the medical council held him accountable.
Which is what happened now, right? Okay, what happened now. I mean, but the thing is, we know you can also argue that there are so many more of patients who probably has been through the system but actually, you know, didn't know better whether they survive or they don't survive. The other thing which is not offering treatment, right, okay, might also be something that is problematic. For example, our in a prostate cancer viewpoint, whenever patients are presented, you know, there are so many options, right? You know, there's to do nothing, you know, to do an operation to take it out as radical as possible or to have radiotherapy. And then under those circumstances, if you don't offer the patient all the options, then technically you should be held accountable. In some way, that is really good because if you don't really take into account, you know, if you cannot just bear the responsibility and say, look, I know best, I think operation is best for you, and that can come back to haunt you.
Coming back to the fact that they're distressed already,
yeah.
Then how do you continue even giving them options. I've already shut down. I'm not listening to you.
I think you have to give them a bit of time. Time is important. And if they have a loved one, friend or family, it can be a very useful set of ears so that it can be the facts can be reiterated and you allow them to come back to the clinic again to have a chat. I also ask them to write down the questions quite often because you may think that you have asked every question, but if they write it down, it helps clear things up. When you talk about hope, that's where the communication is very important. My hope and the patient's hope may be different hopes or the goals that we are trying to achieve. Mm. I may be trying to, as a doctor, extend their quality of life, but that may not be what the patient wants. So we need to come to an agreement as to what both our hopes are before we decide what mode of treatment to go for.
That's also where seeking second or third opinion is also important, because sometimes you speak to Dr. A and you may not be able to actually gel everything, you know, understood everything. So you see another doctor who explains it in another lingo, and it just gels. And you can, you know, now decide to
what you want.
Yeah. But that kind of like has certain aspects of barriers as well. Number one, time, whenever cancer is concerned, sometimes you may not have too much time to go round and round and get opinion. The second thing is obviously to get more and more opinion, it also costs money as well. Yeah. And then for patients to go through all that, you know, distress and everything. So it's a very difficult time for the patient just to, you know, seek opinion. And also the third thing is that the patient also have to be some extent have to be have some degree of background knowledge, because sometimes they, you know, a lot of jargons, how much of that is understood by patient also sometimes is overestimated.
But on the other extreme, you have people who go around from one doctor to another wanting to hear what they want to hear.
Yes, that is.
And that is another challenge, isn't it?
And that's just the medical doctors. What about the alternative medicine that they have?
The neighbours, neighbours as well.
That's right.
It's not
so it's a very confusing time.
But it still doesn't change the fact that we as doctors need to advise them. Similarly, no matter what kind of a patient type of personality that you see today, you still give them the, you know, the right to get the options given to them.
Sure. As per, in the Dr. Ang case, the patient's husband recorded their consultation. Now, how did you feel about that?
Wow. I actually didn't know that. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, because...
I mean, are you okay with that?
You know, if somebody who's actually...
And it's very easy today. I just put on my iPhone and I can...
I've not had recordings, but I've had situations where they've had they have a son or a relative overseas. Yeah. Can I just call someone and so the consult happens?
Yeah. Like during a Skype.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, I have had recordings and then I would perceive as this is... I mean, in inverted commas, difficult patients. So I guess sometimes whenever someone records what you say, you are a lot more cautious, right? About, you know, just kind of every statement, you kind of say, okay, can I back that up? Can I back that up?
Yeah.
But actually, in reality, you probably have to be that anyway. And I have no objection if someone records me and tells me that. And I really think that it's actually somehow rude and intrusive if someone actually just kind of like, you know, record it secretly. I think sometimes people might do that.
Okay. We'll come back and find out more about the private sector and, you know, the cost of seeking treatment for cancer. And then you often hear of stories in which people end up in the government sector when things don't work out. So, and then they're slapped with very high bills. And how do we manage that? That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. It's a Friday, which means Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio with me. Faithfully.
Another heavy subject.
I know. It's coming up to 9 years, George. If you're keeping count. September 4th.
Thanks for reading.
You're as old as we are.
Well, I'm as old as the furniture here.
Yes.
I'm yes. part of the furniture
we'll
now.
We'll have a cutout of you somewhere.
Oh,
one day.
Dear.
Joining us also Dr. Mastura Muhammad Yusuf. She's a consultant oncologist, and Professor Wu Yin Ling, a gynae-oncologist at University of Malaya. We're discussing, a suspension of an oncologist for professional misconduct in Singapore on the 28th of June, 2017. We've gone through quite a number of, we've covered quite a lot of area in terms of ethics and all of that. But I want to ask you, here in Malaysia, the setup is a little different. We have the government sector, we have the private sector. How do we come to some kind of, in your opinion, how do we come to some sort of a compromise where patients are not left with no money seeking cancer treatment? Dr. Mastura.
Okay, because I came from UC Malaya and I left to private 2 years ago, I do get my patients who probably developed a relapse and came over to my hospital now and asking for an opinion. Not to follow
me.
To ask for an opinion.
Okay.
Or they bring their relatives or friends who has been newly diagnosed with cancer to come for an opinion. Mm. But they made it clear to me that they are going to go back to the government for the treatment. They were just there, you know, to get an opinion. Or they were there to... And then I would actually see how I can make the whole thing better. For example, if let's say they're already going to go to the government hospitals, but probably the biopsy or some interventional procedures were delayed, you know, or they had to wait for their appointment or something like that. So if I would ask them whether they have an amount of money or an amount of insurance coverage that can actually make all those processes faster so that they can actually go for treatment earlier.
So basically, rather than having them the actual delay waiting for scans or something like that, they bypass that because they've got the means just to get that sorted
that's
out
right.
first.
So that they get the treatment faster. Sure. And the team in UC Malaya or in Hospital Kuala Lumpur or in IKN can decide faster and easier with all the information at hand.
Okay. Prof Wu?
I think, you're right. We see some quite sad cases, but we do see a heavy, heavy load. I think there needs to be a healthcare system change. You can't... The government hospital can't change on its own. Neither can the private sector change on their own. It needs to be a cooperation, and I guess it needs to be a higher level type of system change. The way we're doing things, I believe that we are not maximizing our resources. For example, we may have only two radiotherapy machines that are available for use for the public sector in the urban Selangor and Wilayah, whereas you may have up to 13 top-notch machines in the surrounding 10 kilometers that is underutilized.
Right.
So you talk about PET scans. Penang has 13 PET scanners.
Right. Where we are struggling. Most of the time not used.
That's right. And the maintenance is so expensive. So we must look beyond just how a small part of management can change. Can we do anything as a country to improve utilizing our resources? And I think insurance company can play a role as well. So in many other countries, insurance payout based on evidence-based medicine.
Mm.
So I remember when I was in the UK, my boss was telling me the insurance was auditing different consultants who did appendicectomies. Why did one person have a 5-day stay consistently and another consultant discharged the patient on the day itself? Mm. And therefore, they remunerate the consultants based on best practice and efficient care.
Yeah, these are quite innovative ideas, isn't it?
That's
like, in order
that's
to...
Right. Yeah, okay. That's right.
Yeah. Very forward-thinking.
Yeah.
Do you think a case like this will have people losing trust in the system? I mean, when you read about these things, then you start to imagine all sorts of things as the layperson. And how do you assure people that your oncologist or your clinician or whoever is making that decision for you or helping you to make that decision when it comes to cancer treatment has your best interest at heart?
Well, I mean, you know, I could see these two ladies completely stunned. In my opinion, when I read this as a clinician, as a patient viewpoint, I kind of like a, as a clinician, I think I had two kind of like thoughts. Number one, I have to be constantly aware that whatever I do has accountability. I think that's number one. That's good thing. And number two is that, like what Masrullah said, I have to update myself all the time. I have that responsibility when I take on the oath, you know, to serve. I think that's important. As a patient, I think rather than losing hope in my clinician, I feel like actually there is a lot of protection for me as a patient. You know, if this is a person in high position, you know, extremely knowledgeable, and then actually was caught in inverted commas for doing this, and there's punishment as a result of that, I feel like the system is clearly working in order to serve the patient as to some degree. So in some way, rather than losing hope of one individual, I feel like overall the medical system itself actually is overall can protect patients. This is my view.
I think the patient should be empowered to ask questions. They should be comfortable enough with their doctors. If they're not, they should be allowed the opportunity to seek another help for another opinion. Doesn't mean they're from a government hospital, they don't ask for other opinions. Very often, I would also, if they do want one, I'll send them to the private sector to get an opinion and come back as well for their treatment. I think that openness is extremely important. Patients can also protect themselves or find out more about how to manage their disease by going to... there's a lot of information that can be obtained from the net. And, of course, there are unreliable, unreliable sites. But if they know that they're managed in a cancer centre or by a, you know, cancer specialist, that should offer some hope. I know not in this case, but...
yeah. Well, some sort of, like, assurance.
Assurance.
That's right.
Assurance.
Okay. I mean, I like the way you say that, you know, patients should be empowered. I think in addition to that empower that you find out more information, seek help, I think from this case, it actually probably highlight that if you document a lot of things, because doctors document what they say to patients,
correct,
you know, when you get consent. And then as a patient, if you say, look, if you don't mind, I either record or document it. I think in this day and age with this case, I think eventually when that becomes a culture, then everyone will make everything in it
open.
They
may feel that they're betraying their doctor by doing that. I mean, they're already dealing with a diagnosis of cancer. It's devastating. And to have to write down and record.
Or write down important things, like, you know, so the doctors say, you know, what are the side effects? The doctors say, what are my chances of survival? The doctor says, what are the potential complications and the costs and that sort of thing. And then just for them to go back and think about it, and perhaps sometime might come back to, you know, just keep a log of how you feel. I think that might be a good idea.
The last question. You know, you have individual rights versus life-saving therapy. If you know that there's not much hope left, Dr. Masro, what do you do?
If you're talking about terminally ill cancer patients, right, and there's not much hope left, we would usually discuss with the patient as well as the caregivers or the family about giving the patients the best comfort possible.
Mm-hmm. But if they insist they want treatment, what do you do then?
If they insist that they want treatment, but to my knowledge, if I give her treatment, him or her treatment, it will be detrimental to her well-being at that time point, right? I would actually ask the patient to seek another opinion elsewhere, because I would not, I mean, that's me individually, I would not actually proceed with treatment if I think that it's going to harm the patient more than giving them best supportive care. So I would actually open the option for the patient to actually see my colleague, whereby I would actually provide them with the information so that my colleague can make the best judgment as to how...
How do you feel if your colleagues offer the treatment that you feel that is inappropriate?
it has happened before.
Of course,
so I'm
sure,
saying
yes,
that as long as my conscience is clear, I don't think I'm going to be affected by other people.
But Mira brought it up earlier on. The patient might just go shop around
until they get what they want.
But like I said, we go by our oath that is not to harm to cure sometimes, you know.
And in this case, harm meaning quality of life.
You're saying?
Terminally ill. You know it's not going to help, make a difference,
right? Yeah.
So comfort, quality of life is what you're talking about.
And harm can be financial as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Very much so.
Yeah, because, you know, what you don't want is you cure someone of a disease and then they landed with huge debt is something that you want
and
to be.
And they die of a heart attack.
Yes.
when they receive the bill.
Trouble.
I think you if you try to understand what's the motivation behind taking such big risks and wanting to have treatment, if we understand why the patient wants this, do they understand that it's not curative?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite important. If they understand that you cannot cure, not giving false hopes, then they may be able to accept.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, I mean, obviously we're talking about cure, you know, pushing that boundary, even though it is not. What about new things, like, you know, new drugs, new techniques and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
How do you handle that? Because they're coming out all the time. They're obviously not really that tried and tested. And then, you know, when your patient's kind of like pushing you for that, how do you handle that?
Well, in order for us to actually even suggest, okay, new drugs,
this
new innovation, this patient suggests. But if there are indications for the suggestion, yes, we can actually consider that, or we can actually look for clinical trials.
That's right.
That have that new drugs to be tested for patients such as this. Because in the context of clinical trial, you lay out to the patient that this is a clinical trial. It may be effective for you. It may not be effective for you. These are the potential side effects. These are the potential benefit. And they actually give permission, you know, their informed consent to participate in a clinical trial. So that is something, and they will be managed and they will be, you know, monitored as they are going through the clinical trial. So I think in our patient population also, that not many patients are aware about clinical research and not many people want to go into clinical research. And in oncology, the clinical research, it's not like they're guinea pigs. You know, most of the clinical research that we do in Malaysia, they get the best treatment there is actually somewhere
tested
else.
And monitored and everything, yeah.
Yeah, and they get the best drugs possible, you know, at that time point. And they also get monitored by the best team, which is the clinical research team.
Course.
Because you need to show, right? It's your platform to prove that this works, right?
Mm.
Can I ask you for a message, Prof? We're running out of time. Your message on the whole Dr. Ang Peng Tiam case, and what do you feel as the layperson, lay people, what should we be taking away from this?
I think the layperson needs to be empowered. They have the right to have the best cancer care within the resources, and in Malaysia, we do. We have a good government sector. We do have a good private sector. So our patients really have a range of care that they can have. So the patient should know that they have the right to these treatments.
I agree with you, and I concur with Prof. Wu. But what I also want to add is, I think we spoke of patient, we spoke of doctor's responsibility, right? But I also would like to highlight the fact that we, as a society, the society bodies, you know, and you know, the Malaysian Medical Council, for example, they need to monitor the activities, you know, of the doctors.
Accountability.
Yeah, accountability of the doctors that are giving patients, that affects patients' lives. We need to actually improve on that, actually. And inclusive of alternative therapies, not just.
I'm not going to go into that because I need another show for the both of you.
Yeah.
Well,
I agree with both of you. I think the way forward, both private and government sector, is multidisciplinary approach.
Correct.
And then if everybody work together, all the doctors work together, we can provide patients with the best care.
Thank you very much for joining me. Dr. Masroor Mohammad Yusuf, a consultant oncologist, Professor Wu Yin Ling, a gynecologist, gynecological oncologist at University of Malaya, and Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.